This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. This is Eva Herr. Thanks for listening tonight. Tonight we're going to talk to Dr. Deborah Davis, and we're going to discuss her book, The Secret History on the War on Cancer. If you have a history of cancer in your family, you will not want to miss this interview. This is one of the best books I've ever read. How are you, Dr. Davis?
I'm fine, thank you.
Wow, what an amazing book. I have to tell you, even though it's about 2 or 3 inches thick, I could not put it down. Can you tell us a little bit about you and your background before we get started?
Well, I grew up in a small town called Donora, Pennsylvania, which is about 30 miles south of Pittsburgh, and it was famous for the fact that people dropped dead there from air pollution, but nobody ever talked about that. And I went away to the big city of Pittsburgh, and when I found out that my hometown was famous, I realized that I grew up surrounded by pollution that affected the health of many members of my family, my grandmother, my father, certainly, and became very interested in this issue, I think, more generally. I'm now at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, where I'm director of the Center for Environmental Oncology, and have an opportunity to put to work with a great group of scientists on how you figure out what causes cancer and what you can do about it.
Now, you did more than just that. You were actually appointed by a past president to research the causes of cancer, right?
Indeed. I served in the Clinton administration. I had a presidential appointment to the National Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board. And most recently, I actually was also on the United Nations panel that just got the Nobel Peace Prize for its work on climate. So I've been around for a while working on various aspects of research involving the environment and our health.
How long has our government known about problems with the toxicology of chemicals and causing cancer in people?
As I point out in my book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, in fact, a lot of people in government and outside of government understood that tobacco was the cause of cancer in the 1930s. They also understood that benzene and asbestos caused cancer back then. But unfortunately, the war on cancer got off on the footing to find the disease, but ignored the things that were known to cause cancer way back when.
So what was, let me get here to my page. We have more people under, say, 40 years old getting cancer right now.
Mm-hmm.
What is the government doing to educate the employers and the people themselves about it?
Well, actually, as I think you know, we're not doing a good enough job of even taking the information that has been gathered by the government itself. I mean, for example, for years, there have been outstanding researchers at the National Cancer Institute and at the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences and at EPA. And these scientists have shown repeatedly, for example, that certain pesticides or certain solvents increase the risk of cancer. And yet our government has not issued warnings. We do not even have requirements for labels on products that we can use on our baby's bottoms to know whether or not they cause cancer in animals or put us at risk. So we've had a lot more information generated by the research community than we have been able to act on.
You talk about in your book how babies that were exposed to certain lotions and things like that got different kinds of cancers. How much exposure does it take, and is that still happening?
Well, the reality is for any given individual, we can seldom say what caused their cancer, but we know that it's not one thing but many things. And for our children, we have to be particularly concerned because they will live long lives because we've eliminated infectious diseases, which used to kill children and the rest of us. But that means that they will also be exposed to many things over the course of their lifetime, and we know that it's the combined effects of these low doses of exposure that over a lifetime add up and put people at risk of developing the disease. In fact, studies were done by Chandra Tiwari, a pediatric endocrinologist who works with us in our center, and who did a case report on 4 young black baby girls who all had breast growth. And he learned by doing very careful interviews with their mothers that their mothers had all applied creams to their scalp that contained placenta, human placenta, which was sold to cosmetic companies and put into creams to soften the hair. When the mother stopped using those creams, the baby's breasts went away. Now, something that can cause a breast to grow in a baby is probably not a good thing for the rest of us to be exposed to.
Right, right. What happened in Louisiana?
Well, Louisiana's fascinating. I was just there recently for another visit. There are a number of towns in the Louisiana Delta, like Mossville and Revealtown, that don't exist anymore. And what happened in those situations was that people complained about pollution, and there was enough basis to the complaint that lawyers were brought in, and they argued that the people ought to be paid and moved for the kinds of pollution that they had experienced. So, in fact, the town of Revealtown and the town of Mossville don't exist anymore. These were in the Bayou Thurle, just south of Baton Rouge and south of Iberville Parish, near Calcasieu Parish. And back in 1978, a 20-year-old truck driver named Kirtley Jackson dumped a truck full of hazardous waste directly into an open pit that ran into the bayou. People did those things back then. Nobody knows exactly what happened, but whatever it was, something in the waste he dumped reacted with those already in the pit, and he died instantly. Well, public notice of the death of Kirtley Jackson was one of the first things to bring attention to the need for some kind of law to protect people from toxic trash. But often people have no means of getting help, and Louisiana is under the Napoleonic Code, and as a consequence, when water flows over the land, it's still, instead of that land then going back to the state, it's owned by whoever owns the land. And so people can do all kinds of things to the land if the water is over it. And one of the things they did was to develop enormous flagship chemical plants, including Georgia Gulf's flagship plant in Revealtown, Louisiana. Well, people got together there and complained in 1987, and the company responded by buying up the entire town.
Amazing.
It paid the residents for their homes and leveled the neighborhood.
Are there preventive testing that can be done right now? Because people get exposed to the chemicals and the benzenes and the things in plastics. Are there things that we can do to test right now?
Well, you know, I actually don't recommend people do testing of themselves right now for several reasons. First of all, it's quite expensive. Secondly, and more importantly, we all are exposed. There's no question about it in terms of modern life. So what you can do, though, and I think it's important to recognize this, is that you can avoid getting additional exposure by taking some basic precautions in things that you do and looking and reading labels of things that you bring into your home and making sure that you use greener products where you can, although green is not a guarantee, because a lot of things that claim to be green are not necessarily that much safer for you. So we really need the government and the private sector here to step up to the plate and do a better job of formulating materials. But
what
testing
about,
yourself, I think testing is something that we're not ready to do. We don't have inexpensive tests readily available. And we do know from the Centers for Disease Control that babies are born today with levels of pollutants in their bodies that didn't exist 10 years ago.
What about aspartame? You see it everywhere you go, Equal.
Yeah.
What does the government know about that, and why have they not done something about it? I said in your book you wrote about the FDA's chief counsel requested a grand jury.
Right.
Talk about the false statements and the information that they hid. What do they know?
Well,
and what do we know?
Well, what we knew, in 1977, it was really quite fascinating, the general counsel of the G.D. Searle Company, the general counsel of the FDA, I'm sorry, sought a grand jury indictment of the G.D. Searle Company, alleging that they had submitted fraudulent information about the safety of aspartame. And in response, the company that same year hired Donald Rumsfeld. Now, they didn't hire him because he was an expert in pharmacology. They hired him because they thought he might be able to help them deal with the political process, and indeed that turned out to be the case. Because in 1981, the day after Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, the company filed for approval of aspartame. Now, they did that in 1981, although there was no new scientific evidence on the safety of aspartame. And the earlier data was considered insufficient by every scientific review group that had ever looked at it. So what happened here was obviously the political process intervened, and although every single FDA review board had voted against approving aspartame, and the grand jury investigation fizzled, so much time had elapsed from the time the grand jury was first impaneled that it had expired. And the clock literally had run out, so that whether or not the evidence was considered fraudulent became irrelevant.
Are they going to do anything about it?
Pardon?
Are they going to do it, or is it just...
Well, that's a good question because of what's happened very recently. In the past year, we know that aspartame is now one of the most commonly used ingredients in drinks, cakes, cookies, candies. And by the way, there is no evidence that it helps people lose weight. And there's some indication it creates a sugar deficit, leading people to seek more sugar from other sources. But leaving aside the question of whether it has any benefits, as to its safety, there have been a number of reports questioning that, the most recent of which comes from Italy, from the Ramazzini Foundation in Bologna, Italy, where they did something I think rather important. They test animals by letting them live their natural lifetimes, which is 3 years. And they tested animals here using levels of exposure to aspartame that would be equivalent to about 2 cans of diet soda, 2 yogurts, a diet custard, and maybe a couple cups of coffee a day. So this is not a huge quantity, a huge dose. And when they did this, they found that if they started exposing the animals prenatally, before they were born, that by the time the animals reached the equivalent of their 60s, 70s, or 80s, a good many of them had cancer.
But that's not really that many years. It's, what, 3 or 4 years?
Well, yes. For an animal, it's 3 years. That's equivalent to for a human getting to their 60s or 70s. And the thing that's really, I think, concerns me a great deal is that 2 out of every 3 Americans is regularly using aspartame right now.
Oh, absolutely.
And there is really good reason for concern about its long-term effects. And right now, there are... The FDA, as far as I know, has not taken any plans or to reevaluate whether or not this material ought to be so widely used.
You talked in your book about Harry Weissman's study with the monkeys, because people don't believe when we tell them that it's bad for them, because they say it wouldn't be on the market if it were bad. What happened to those monkeys?
Yeah, it's kind of strange. People assume that if you can buy something, it's been proven to be safe. But Harry Weissman, in 1969, took aspartame to 7 infant monkeys. And after a year of drinking milk flavored with aspartame, 1 was dead, and 5 had suffered severe epileptic seizures. Well, unfortunately, that work never got completed. Weissman himself died. But other researchers, John Olney at St. Louis University, at Washington University, in St. Louis, showed that aspartame paired with the food flavoring monosodium glutamate produced brain tumors in rats. There were a lot of people who were very concerned about this, including a number of FDA scientific reviewers.
So why does it something happen? Is it money?
It's not just money. The fact of the matter is people want to believe that there's a quick fix to losing weight. You know how there's a reason for these markets. You know, there's a reason why people are always searching for the next cure. And the reality is the combination of their willing belief that there is some kind of magic cure and the powerful nature of the lobbyists who can keep these things before us have combined, and I think they put our health at risk as a consequence.
do the pharmaceutical companies, did they realize from the beginning that drugs can cause cancers and diseases?
Well, you know, as someone who's lost both of my parents to cancer, I do appreciate that chemotherapy has improved dramatically its ability to save some people from dying from cancer.
So,
but having said that, it is certainly true that we know that many of the forms of drugs and radiation that we use to treat cancer also cause other cancers to develop.
That was one of my questions was going to be, why do some people appear to get well when they do chemotherapy or radiation and others don't?
You know, that's a very good question. And the revolution in biology now is taking place in our understanding of the interactions of genes and the environment. You know, if we have identical twins, by the time they are age 50, their chromosomes don't even look like they're related to one another. So that's telling
really?
Us, that is telling us that although they start out in life identical, split from one egg, by the time they get to be 50, when we look very closely at their chromosomes, they do not even look necessarily related. So that is, I think, a very powerful indication of the fact that genes give us the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. And it's understanding the way the environment interacts with our genes and our diet that is, I think, going to lead us to a much better understanding of how we can deal with this disease. But the reality now is that people will respond differently to chemotherapy depending on what they eat, where they live. We have research being done by Dr. Talal El-Hefnawi in our laboratory that shows that ambient levels of certain pollutants can interfere with chemotherapy.
Interesting. Do the research that gets done, who funds most of it?
Well, a great deal of research is funded by the pharmaceutical industry because, of course, there's a lot of money to be made from finding and treating cancer. Our center is funded by the Heinz Endowments, by major foundations in Pittsburgh like the Highmark Foundation, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and we also get money from the National Cancer Institute through a comprehensive grant to our University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, which is a major National Cancer Institute center. But a lot of money for research on the environment has been drastically cut. The EPA, the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences now, have the lowest funding in modern times because of the budget right now that we face for the government. So funding for this kind of work is very, very limited. That's one of the reasons why we've set up a foundation to try to generate more support for this sort of work. Our Center for Environmental Oncology, has its motto, making prevention the cure for cancer.
But the studies that are funded by the pharmaceutical companies, are they manipulated?
Well, that's not an easy question to answer. Obviously, there have been a lot of really good books written about that. Marcia Angel, a former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, has done an excellent job of documenting the conflict of interest that has characterized publications in major journals by pharmaceutical industries. So, yes, there's been a lot of conflict of interest involving pharmaceutical industries. And in my book, I document the underhanded techniques of some of the chemical industries as well.
That's one of the best books I've ever read, I have to tell you.
Oh.
It really, really is such an important book. One of the other things I wanted to ask is, I've had teachers at my children's school push me to put my children on Ritalin or Adderall. Is it safe to do that?
I don't know. I really wish I did. What I do know is that one small study looked at 12 children and looked at their blood to look at measures of genetic damage. Now, let me explain. All of us get genetic damage all the time as a result of being alive. And we get that genetic damage gets repaired, which is why we don't all get cancer all the time. So this study looked at the level of genetic damage in children before they were on Ritalin and after. And unfortunately, every single one of these 12 children developed double to triple the amount of genetic damage after being on Ritalin for just 3 months. Now, I would think that based on this finding, the companies would be eager to find out whether this is a problem. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet. And so what we have is an experiment going on, because as you know, millions of children are using Ritalin now, mm-hmm. and we don't have any way to know whether it may be having an effect, a damaging effect, on the chance that they're going to develop cancer or other diseases later on.
What about cell phones?
Well, it's the same problem. I can't tell you they're safe, and I can't tell you that they're harmful. But what I can tell you is that studies that have been done in Sweden and in other countries where they've used cell phones for longer have found that people who have used cell phones for 10 years or more have double the risk of a tumor of the hearing nerve called acoustic neuroma and double the risk of glioblastoma, which is a malignant tumor of the brain. We are actually starting a new study at the University of Pittsburgh now looking at this question of whether there is a relationship between acoustic neuroma and cell phone use. What I recommend, as does the governments of England, France, and Germany at this point, is that you use a cell phone with a speakerphone or a hollow-tubed earpiece or a Bluetooth accessory, because that minimizes the microwave radiation into your brain. I also advise that children only use a cell phone for an emergency, and it is illegal to sell a cell phone to a child under the age of 16 in Bangalore, India. So there's a growing awareness that cell signals, which are microwave signals, do penetrate the brain, and this isn't a good thing to do to the developing brain of a child, even if the cancer risk is not something we can be certain of at this time.
I was talking to a guy, Larry Burks, his name, he's a radiologist. I can't think of where he was practicing, but he told me that they took two petri dishes of glial cells, and one of them they put into an MRI for 15 minutes. And afterwards, after I think he said 3 days, the glial cells that was in the petri dish that went into the MRI had quadrupled. Do you think that those radiological techniques affect those kinds of cancers?
Well, I don't know anything about that work, and an MRI is a magnetic resonance imaging, is different from a CAT scan, which is radiological, which is ionizing radiation, which breaks bonds and clearly can damage genes. So ionizing radiation, like you get from a CAT scan, I think clearly can be damaging. And there's no question about that, that radiation is known to cause cancer. In fact, we also can use radiation to treat cancer. And so young girls who have had Hodgkin's disease and been treated with radiation to the chest before age 15, by the time they reach age 40, 1 in 4 of them will have breast cancer. So radiation clearly does increase the risk of cancer, and that's well established in terms of human studies. I am not familiar with magnetic resonance imaging effects.
Well, I don't think that study was published because he kind of bit his tongue after he told me, but it really shocked me. What about mammograms and things like that? Do you recommend women get mammograms?
Mammograms in women after menopause and just before menopause can be life-saving. And if you have a symptom at any time, you need to see a doctor, and they can recommend whether you should have a mammogram. A diagnostic mammogram is different than a screening mammogram. I just had my screening mammogram. I'm well past menopause, and I think it's a good idea. But for people who are young, for people who have very dense breasts, I think mammograms are oversold and understudied, and we need to develop an alternative to mammography to find breast cancer earlier and to come up with ways to prevent it. And some of the research we're doing at our Center for Environmental Oncology is designed to do that.
What about, what's the difference between a mammogram and a thermogram? Would it be better to get a thermogram?
Well, a mammogram involves ionizing radiation through the fatty tissue of the breast with the breast compressed between a plate to see if you can find evidence of microcalcifications or other signs of tumor. A thermogram uses heat to detect patterns of heat because we know that tumors are hotter. At this time, thermography has not been shown to be as as effective as mammography in picking up early signs of tumors, but I understand that there's more research underway to develop this technology further. And my advice is that young women avoid screening mammograms, but may need to have a mammogram if they've got a symptom.
Okay. What about our cosmetics? I know we touched on that at the very beginning, but particularly deodorants, are they causing problems? I hear about aluminum being in that. Does that cause a problem?
Well, it depends on what you mean by cause, because the problem is we do not have human data on the impact of any of these specific cosmetics on our health. And part of the problem is to get human data, you need to have people exposed and people unexposed so you can compare them with that. And we don't have any unexposed people to many modern conveniences and modern cosmetics and things like antiperspirants. So what we do know is that there are a number of ingredients that are widely used in personal care products that have been shown to accelerate cell growth and are suspected of increasing cancer. An excellent source of information on that can be found through the website of my book, DevoraDavis.com, or EWG.org. That's the Environmental Working Group, which has been leading a safe cosmetics campaign and has excellent material on ingredients in sunscreen and personal care products that you ought to avoid.
What can you tell us a little bit about what happened in El Paso at the American Smelting? And because that happens a lot around the country, doesn't it?
Well, El Paso is a very interesting story because I first studied El Paso, you know, back in 1980, and I thought at that point I was studying a piece of history because it was known back in 1980 it was famous for having had massive lead poisoning in the area. But more recently what's happened there is that the small area of Smelter Town right under the Asarco smelter was evacuated after the lead poisoning was first discovered, and now starting in the 1990s the smelter was engaged in what was called turning waste to energy, but it was basically engaged in sham recycling, where they took hazardous waste with little or no recoverable metal value and mixed them into their alleged products. And the Justice Department and EPA documented this record of sham recycling, and there's a memo on it that can be found on the book's website disclosing that this was really not real recycling, but they were saying they were recycling, and in the name of that, then burning these continuous top-speed oxygen process furnaces. These hot-burning ovens went all day and night, burning tons of toxic waste at 90% efficiency. Well, 90% efficiency means 10% inefficiency. And 10% of hundreds of thousands of tons of waste fired over several years left enough metal poisons in the region that the furnaces were finally put out of business by the U.S. Department of Justice after operating just 7 years. That's, I think, an appalling indication of the sorts of things that have gone on where, in the name of what's called recycling, they're basically spreading waste throughout a large area. Now, the residents of El Paso and Juarez, Mexico, know about this pollution because they faced more than a century's worth of leaden soils and plumes that have been spread around the area. But the thing that really stunned me was to learn that in 1999, Asarco was bought for more than $1 billion. And today, it's completely owned by Grupo México as a subsidiary. So what happened in the sale was that the company had set aside money to pay for cleaning up El Paso because it was recognized that El Paso was dirty. But in the sale, the company was allowed to use the money set aside to clean up to pay down corporate debt. So of the estimated $6 billion in cleanup costs for old Asarco sites throughout the U.S., the firm now has less than $100 million.
That's amazing. You also talked, Is there any kind of criteria that will prohibit researchers, and I'm talking about where you talk about, is it Trichopoulos?
Mm-hmm. Trichopoulos.
And Dahl.
Right.
Trichopoulos at Harvard and Dahl of Oxford, to keep people from secretly working for the chemical industry and working for public service at the same time?
No, there really isn't. And, you know, it's a very tough set of issues, because there are people in epidemiology who are doing good, important work, and some of them may work for industry. But what happened in the case of the work on vinyl chloride that was done by Richard Dahl was that he was secretly getting paid by Monsanto and producing publications saying that vinyl chloride was not as bad as people thought, but there was no, he was not disclosing that he was being paid at the time for his work. And while I have enormous respect for the great things that Sir Richard Dahl did do in epidemiology, he did amazingly important work on asbestos and tobacco. It's also true that he was an industry consultant and did not disclose that he was an industry consultant for years. And so we will never know what really happened to influence his opinion that vinyl chloride was not really so toxic, or his views that asbestos was a problem of the past. It's very difficult to look at the point of history to understand how sponsorship for someone can affect what they have to say. But the reality is that researchers are obliged to use the best methods to inform people of what they find and to disclose where their support comes from. But as one of my colleagues noted, in epidemiology, you are not just known by the company you keep, but by the company that keeps you. And we'll probably never know whether Dahl, Adami, and Trichopoulos' idea about how scientists should study industrial hazards were at all colored by the fact that these eminent epidemiologists secretly served as highly paid consultants for a number of industries for years. We'll never know.
Speaking of asbestos, is it still allowed in this country?
Oh, indeed. Asbestos is still allowed in this country, and there are 35 million American homes that may have asbestos in their attics in the form of zonolite insulation, which can be contaminated with tremolite. And Christy Todd Whitman tried to issue a public warning campaign about this in the Bush administration and was not allowed to do so by the Office of Management and Budget. But if you go to the EPA website and you type in zonolite insulation, you'll find the warnings on their website, but you have to know enough to look and to ask. And the reality is that the amount of asbestos you can be exposed to, if you're a homeowner trying to do wiring in your attic and you're disturbing the insulation, can be enough to give you a chance of developing a suffocating tumor of the lung 30 years later called mesothelioma. And 1 in 3 cases of mesothelioma today occurs in someone who has never been known to work with asbestos.
You would think they would have learned about that with Dow Corning and all that litigation.
Well, yes.
You have done a considerable amount of research in your life, and you've tried to present evidence to your superiors and to government agencies. What kind of acceptance did you get?
Well, I guess it depends on the different groups. You know, there are some places I've been really encouraged by the cooperation I've received from some people in industry now who want to come clean and want to see us do better by people who have suffered as a result of exposures. And there have been other areas that I've been blackballed from, but that's the price that one pays. And I think at this point, my book is receiving a lot more public discussion and a lot more support than it would have, say, 20 years ago. Because people are ready to listen, and we see the evidence around us every day in that we are seeing more cases of cancer in children. A million cancer survivors today under the age of 40. And we are also seeing younger cases of colorectal and pancreas and liver cancer. So we know something's happening now to influence the patterns of cancer. And we're doing a major project at our center looking at rates of cancer, and we have certainly found that while rates of cancer overall are declining, that is chiefly because fewer people are smoking and fewer women and men are getting breast and prostate cancer. That's the effect we think of screening is working to prevent people from getting the disease. And because fewer men are smoking, cancer deaths are falling. But there's more new cases of cancer in children, and children are not getting cancer because they smoke. And there's more cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in older women who are also not smoking as much. So we're seeing patterns of cancer today increasing that have nothing to do with smoking and nothing to do with aging.
What are PCBs, the thing that, I had this client one time, I worked in a law firm, and her husband would put his hands down in the transformers, and some other men there did too, and they all got cancers in their livers. But she, when she tried to do something about it, the power company burned her house down, murdered her sister. Well, there's no proof of this, but all these things happened within 2 or 3 months. What are companies like that doing now? Or is the government doing anything to stop that?
Well, under the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976, PCBs were phased out. But although they've been phased out, they're highly persistent materials, and they were used in capacitors and widespread use throughout the country. We know they're very persistent. They're, you know, three main types of PCBs, and they can have a variety of biological effects. And at this point, they are no longer being used. Most uses have been canceled. But are they a problem? Yes, of course they are. And this is an example of something where we've got to be smarter and not just export our old equipment, but really recycle and retrieve materials that are more toxic, because once they get into the environment, they really don't get out.
What about plastics? How safe are they for us to use and microwave in or put heated materials in?
Well, plastics make a lot of modern things possible in life. But there's a form of plastic, polyvinyl chloride plastic, the hardened type, which can have bisphenol A in it, and Nalgene, the bottle manufacturer, and a number of baby bottle manufacturers are moving to remove it from their plastic because the evidence is growing that some plastic can mobilize toxic material from that plastic into our food. And children's levels of certain contaminants in their bodies are higher than their parents, perhaps because they eat food with more of this plastic lining or drinking out of these hardened plastic bottles. So there's, again, the Canadian government has just announced its intention to ban bisphenol A, BPA, which is a contaminant found in plastic number 7, made out of polyvinyl chloride. If you look at the bottom of a plastic container, it has numbers 1 through 7. Forget about 6 and 7, and forget about 3. So you can think of it, 5, 4, 1, and 2 are good for you.
5, 4, 1, and 2.
Right.
What happens when people warm when the bad ones
when
are warmed up?
When you heat hardened plastic, according to studies at the University of Cincinnati, you can get 55 times the level of bisphenol A into the liquid that you've heated. So it's really not recommended that you heat in that kind of plastic at all.
What I'd like to know about the American Medical Association, how proactive have they been, and what was their participation with the tobacco industry?
Well, that's a fascinating story. Morris Fishbein, who was the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association, was a brilliant man, and he had on the idea of modern advertising using doctors to convey their expert opinion about which tobacco was good for you. And there are these incredible ads that you can find on our website as well, of physicians recommending Camel cigarettes, for example. Mm-hmm. But in addition, the American Medical Association took $10 million in funding from the tobacco industry to to do research to develop a safe cigarette. And that was a pretty astonishing chapter because that money was given to the American Medical Association long after the U.S. Surgeon General's report had appeared saying that tobacco was the cause of cancer. So the American Medical Association was somewhat slow to the cancer-tobacco connection and actually for years contributed studies that called into question the association between tobacco and poor health.
What about Dr. Kehoe's work with chemicals?
Well, Kehoe was a very interesting guy. He was a brilliant teacher, and he figured out how lead could be made safely without endangering workers, which was very important. But it wasn't safe enough, and we know that lead poisoning arose in workers and in others affected by lead. Kehoe himself was a very interesting fellow, and he went over to Germany right in June of 1945 when the war ended with Germany, but was still going on with the Japanese. And the Ethyl Corporation was the company that made lead and gasoline. And Kehoe was the medical director of the Ethyl Corporation at the time that he went over to Germany. Standard Oil owned the Ethyl Corporation. And for years, they went to great lengths to keep the fatal costs of producing leaded gasoline well hidden. I disclose that part of that, keeping the costs hidden, was to result in, unfortunately, a lot of people becoming sick as a consequence. Well, Kehoe figured out how lead could be made safely, and then he worked to see that companies all over the world that were making leaded gasoline were doing so in a safe manner. But the U.S. War Department issued an order to the Ethyl Corporation not to give the formula for leaded gasoline to the Germans or the Italians or the Japanese. Ethyl was truly a global firm, and it had independently joined forces with Hitler's staunchest corporate supporters, forming the firm Ethyl Gemeinschaft in 1934. And even though they were ordered not to give the formula for ethyl gasoline to the Germans, the company did do so. And I found memos after the war in German saying how they would never have been able to fight and against us if they hadn't had the formula for lead and gasoline.
So they were able to use that against our government, and they let it happen.
Well, I don't know. I can't say that they let it happen. I don't know that they were I don't think the government had any power to prevent it. And Kehoe worked for the Ethyl Corporation and oversaw the safety of the production of leaded gasoline, which was used to fight against American GIs. But the other thing he did was he went over to Germany when the war ended.
What happened to the people that they know did deliberate acts like that?
Well, that's an interesting thing. A few people were prosecuted at the Nuremberg trials, right? But one of them who was not was Ferdinand Fleury. Ferdinand Fleury was known to have perfected antidotes to poison gas because he had also created poison gas in the first place. Mm-hmm. He was Germany's most distinguished toxicologist. And on July 21st, 1945, Kehoe took custody of Fleury and had him released. Well, Fleury knew all about how poison gas worked, and he was in Kehoe's custody and never prosecuted. But there was this notion that we prosecuted all of the guilty parties at Nuremberg. Well, in fact, I don't think that we did, and I make that clear in my book. There were a lot of people who contributed to the work of the Nazis, including many physicians, and none of them was prosecuted. Another fellow who was not prosecuted, of course, was Werner von Braun, who became arranged for the surrender of, other German rocket scientists with himself, and then became kind of a hero in America for making rockets. But he also made rockets for the Germans. He oversaw the production of the V-2 rocket. The production of the V-2 rocket itself involved deaths of concentration camp inmates involved in producing it, and killed 3,000 people in London when the rockets were fired. And that was what Wernher von Braun's main job was during the war. Yet he was never prosecuted for any of that work.
Oh, it just makes me livid to think about this thing. Let's talk for just a minute about pesticides. You mentioned in your book that rats exposed prenatally to just a single injection had a lot of problems with excitability and focusing issue and brain problems. Is that, how does that affect our children, and how much do they, does it have to get into them before it has some effect on them?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, and research was done last year at the California Public Health Institute that found that autism was increased as a function of how much pesticides were sprayed in the areas of California. Now, we don't know why autism is increased. It is increased. Some of the increase is certainly due to we're measuring it more and counting it better. But this study from California is consistent with some of the animal studies that have found that a single injection at a critical time of development in animals can lead to behavioral problems in those animals developing as they age.
What do you think about, word just went out of my head, immunization?
Well, I think immunization is very important, otherwise children are going to die of infectious diseases again, and we've already seen some epidemics of measles and mumps in children who are not immunized. For the past 4 years, there has not been mercury in the vaccines that are being used in the hospital, at McGee Hospital in Pittsburgh, and in most major medical centers.
So
the vaccine tie to autism is not clear at this time.
How has it affected your life since your book came out? Has it affected your employability or anything?
Well, I don't know yet, but so far I still have a job, and actually I have to say the University of Pittsburgh has been very generous in supporting what I'm trying to do. It's certainly the case that we get at this point no money from the pharmaceutical industry, and nor have we ever sought it. We are working with people in green businesses who are interested in trying to promote green practices, because we recognize that that's the wave of the future. And we're hoping to continue to get grants from foundations, because that's really what has allowed us to do what we've done so far.
I lost my train of thought again. Oh, I was, you know, the world is changing how we're employed. You know, it used to be people in mines all over the place, and now it's switching to computers and technological things. What areas of employment do we have to worry about today?
Well, we have different risks today. And one of the things, though, even though the United States has a lower proportion of our workforce in blue-collar jobs than any other time in history, we have often exported hazards. So we take smelters and dismantle them in Tacoma, Washington, and then they get reassembled in Latin America, in Mexico, in Brazil.
What was that you said got reassembled?
The smelters.
What's a smelter?
A smelter is a large furnace that can melt lead and zinc or other things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're off, and they can be very polluting. So that kind of pollution in the United States today is less. But it's less because we're shipping that pollution out, we're outsourcing it, if you will.
What about toxins in computers?
Well, computers and electronic manufacturing is clearly implicated as hazardous in some studies that have been done in Scotland, in China, as well as some observations of my colleague Richard Clapp, when studying the IBM workforce of microelectronics industry. So yes, there are new hazards today. They are different than old hazards. And it's clear that some modern jobs place their employees at risk.
Are they taking any precautions? Or what can we do to protect ourselves?
Well, increasingly in the United States, where they're making computers, they're doing it with something called lights-out manufacturing. So robots are doing it, and that's one way to reduce risk.
You also, your secretary, I think, sent me a list of things that you can do to try to prevent cancers. Could you just go over a few of those things?
Well, if you live in an area like in Pennsylvania with high radon levels, you have to have radon tested. You should certainly, if you have any reason to be concerned about insulation in your attic, you need to have a professional tell you if you have asbestos in your attic. That's important. Looking under your sink and reading labels and recognizing, by the way, that you can clean your home with baking soda, vinegar, and toothpaste in many instances, and getting rid of toxic cleaning products is a helpful thing to do as well.
Let me ask you this before I forget. What about fluoride?
Well, recent studies certainly indicate that we do not need as much supplemental fluoride, and there's a lot of concern that has been expressed about the long-term consequences of fluoride, but frankly, it's not an issue that I'm an expert on.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Just thought about that.
No, that's fine. I think the important thing is this. The world is going green, and green makes a great deal of sense as long as it is less toxic. And I think that we're seeing general movement in that direction. And our center is part of that because we are helping to green and helping to advise other hospitals and our own hospital system in getting rid of toxic materials in the hospital, using microfiber mops to clean so we use less water, less toxic cleaning materials, and using more efficient energy and using some renewable energy. And all of that is part of reducing the potential for cancer down the road.
What do you think about bioidentical hormones? Are they any different from the regular hormones that the doctors give out?
I have no reason to think they are any different. I realize there are people who believe that they are. But I think that that is a study that needs to be done. But at this point, there's no biological reason to think that bioidentical hormones will be less damaging than synthetic ones, although people are using lower doses of them, and I think lower doses are generally better.
And I don't think you covered this in your book, but I want to ask you, since it's your background, do you think that it makes a difference whether you take pharmaceutically engineered supplements as opposed to taking organic supplements?
You know, I can't give you a general answer to that. I think that pharmaceutically engineered materials can be very valuable, and in cases in Africa where they do not have the resources to get materials other ways, I think that it makes some sense. But we need to be smarter, and we need to institute controls for reviewing safety and practices in engineering materials.
Do they work as well?
I don't know.
Okay. We've got just a couple of minutes. I'd like for you to take this opportunity to tell people where they can find you. And also, anything that we've not covered that you would like to say, go ahead and say that.
Well, thank you. First of all, I really appreciate your interest and commitment in the book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. It did take me a long time to write it. The center's website is preventingcancernow.org. It has a lot of good information about things you can do to reduce your risk of developing cancer or reduce the chance it will come back. We've also started a foundation, the Deverly Davis Charitable Foundation, in order to support work on preventing cancer. And we're working with other groups like the Environmental Working Group, the Breast Cancer Fund, the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, and a host of others that you can find by linking to our newsletter and to our website, because we are working to make prevention a cure for cancer.
Well, I think I'm so grateful that I just ran across your site. I've given this book to so many people you just wouldn't believe.
Well, I thank you so much. It means a lot to me to talk to someone who is
so is there
as
anything
intelligent
else
well informed.
You'd like to say that we haven't?
I just would say this. Sometimes people get overwhelmed with all of this and they say, look, this is impossible. And there's a story from the Talmud that I want to share with your listeners, because it's something I think about. A group of workers are told they have a job to do, and they say, are you kidding? We can't do this. It's impossible. We don't have the right tools. We'll never get it done. And the response of the rabbi is, look, it's not up to you to finish this task, but you must begin it. And that's where we are. And I think we are going to make progress, and I think more and more people recognize that. That's why green is the new black. That's why people are looking for safer, cleaner, and greener alternatives. And that's why I think more and more people are reading my book and sharing it with others, because we know that we can make a difference, and we're not going to solve the problems of the future with the same technologies that have created them.
We've got a minute or two. Is there anything or any organization or any particular bill that people could address and write their representatives?
Well, there is. I think we have to pay attention to proposals right now to require chemical flame retardants, which the Consumer Product Safety Commission is considering. There's a proposal now to require that a cell phone not burn when you hold it over a candle.
What?
Yes, I'm not making this up.
Maybe I missed that. Tell me again.
Well, the idea here is if you had to make cell phones so that they wouldn't catch on fire when you held them over a candle.
I didn't know they did that.
The only way you would do that is by pumping them full of chemicals, which would then make it impossible to recycle them. So, in fact, Arlene Bloom and I and others are working to see that this proposal to require flame retardants in plastic gets defeated, because it would result in the use of hundreds of millions of gallons of highly toxic fluorinated compounds that would make plastic not burn, but would also create massive contamination, as it has done in other situations. So we want to be aware of that there are some proposals that sounds like a great idea to avoid fires, right? But
yeah.
avoiding fires that don't really happen, because there actually has never been a case of someone dying from a cell phone catching on fire. In fact, I don't know if there's any cases of cell phones actually catching on fire at all, by the way. It's important to recognize that sometimes what appears to be a good idea for public health may be a very bad idea, and can be a wolf in sheep's clothing. And I think that's exactly what's going on with this proposal to require that our plastics be flame-proof.
Interesting. I didn't even know about that.
But another thing that people have to organize around is the fact that there are no requirements for safety or monitoring of carcinogens in personal care products for the FDA. The FDA does not have the authority to measure or monitor whether there's a carcinogen in your baby's bubble bath.
What about, we've got 1 minute left, what about our makeups?
Well, that is also relevant. The FDA has no authority to monitor or measure what's in our makeup. And that's why the Safe Cosmetics campaign has been launched. And there are over 400 companies that have signed on agreeing to not use known carcinogens in their cosmetics. And we need to get the large companies, not just the government,
right,
but we need to get the Avon involved in this and Revlon. And the big companies have to agree to stop using carcinogens and other toxicants in their makeup.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Davis. We're out of time, but I really do appreciate your work. I'm grateful for it, and thank you for coming on my show.
Well, thank you, and preventingcancernow.org will give your listeners more information.
And your book, The Secret History, War on Cancer, you've got to have it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
And good night. Bye-bye.